Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started.
Hi, everyone. Renee Powers here. We have another fantastic interview for you today. Koa Beck is the author of White Feminism, and I learned so much from this book, and I just really cherish the opportunity and time that Koa took to explain white feminism to us and write this book. So I hope you enjoyed this interview. Just a couple of things to keep an eye out for. We are going to be doing some really cute Valentine's Day gifts in our shop, so keep an eye out for those. If you're not on our email list, that's where you will be the first to know when these things go live. So make sure that you are on our email list. We do have a link to that in the show notes. If you haven't listened to one of our episodes in the new year, we are going to be changing the format of this show in the early spring. The coming weeks, we are working behind the scenes to do a lot of things, but one of those things is to bring on more voices, co-hosts, correspondents to really revamp this show. I think you're going to adore what we have in store for you, and I can't wait to introduce you to everyone that we have brought on board so far, and I think that this is exactly the direction that Feminist Book Club, the podcast, needed to go. But until then, you will continue to get these fantastic author interviews. The slate of authors I have coming up for you, oh, chef's kiss, they are excellent. So make sure you are subscribed. Make sure you rate and review this podcast in your podcatcher of choice. That goes a long way. We really do appreciate it. It helps others find us and helps us grow. And when we grow, we can do more good and bring feminism to more people in this world. So thank you for your support and enjoy this interview.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. I am chatting today with Koa Beck. Koa is the former editor-in-chief of Jezebel. Previously, she was the executive editor of Vogue.com and the senior features editor at MarieClaire.com. Her literary criticism and reporting have been featured in The Atlantic, Out, The New York Observer, The Guardian, Esquire, and many others. In 2019, she was awarded the Joan Shorenstein Fellowship at the Harvard Kennedy to research her book, White Feminism, From the Suffragettes to Influencers and Who They Leave Behind. We are talking about that book today. Welcome, Koa.
Thank you for having me.
I am so excited to chat with you today. And I ask everybody the same question first. And I think we're just going to dive into all facets of this question. But the question is, what does it mean to you to be feminist?
I think the best way for me to answer that is more so along the lines of how I interpret feminism. I interpret feminism both historically and contemporary as a collective endeavor. So in terms of assessing systems that disenfranchise marginalized genders and identifying those systems and dismantling them and protesting against them together, as opposed to, you know, very individualized, optimized pathways to overcome patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So let's dive in. White feminism is the title of your book. What is white feminism?
White feminism is a very specific ideology to achieving gender equality that relies on a lot of different tenets that we normally associate with patriarchy. So white feminism pulls considerably from white supremacy, from labor exploitation, from corporate ascension, as well as, I think the best way to say this is like individualized understanding of both oppression, but also overcoming oppression.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit before we started recording, and I mentioned that my master's thesis was on post-feminism. And one of the tenets of post-feminism is that we can buy our empowerment. We can buy equality. And white feminism, see, I mean, post-feminism is white feminism in a lot of ways. And so I'd love to hear you talk a bit more about how white feminism is complicit in late capitalism.
Well, white feminism from the inception, so a big part of how I structured this book was grounding white feminism specifically in history and in the beginning of what we think of as organized women's rights in the United States. So since the beginning, since the suffragists, partnering with consumerism has been a very prominent avenue towards political prowess and influencing spheres so that they're, you know, quote unquote, better for women. One of the facets that I explore in my book is that in my research, I come to a lot of understanding of suffrage, right, from this very like post-Trump landscape of like, you know, hashtag resist wear and like feminist as fuck mugs and, you know, all these things that are now kind of ubiquitous in quote unquote feminist spaces. But I learned through writing my book that those avenues are not new at all. Suffragists created a sort of advertisement, you know, within various suffrage groups to fashion like what the quote unquote suffragette looked like, and accessories, things you could buy, things to convey the fact that you supported women's suffrage in terms of like sashes, buttons, hats, pins, playing cards, like that was all very much a part of their platform. And their idea behind this was that, you know, as they were moving into the century, having, you know, not really secured suffrage, despite the efforts of like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and like those people, they realized that a big problem they had as organizers was that, you know, women who spoke publicly, who operated outside of the home, who drew attention to themselves, those were considered very deviant women. And so they embarked on this with, you know, almost like a PR challenge. Like, how do we change that perception of the woman who's standing on the street corner screaming about the right to vote? And the way that they did that was through consumerism and advertisements. And they crafted this very homogenized look, which is very apparent when you go through historical archives of who a suffragette was. And she was young, she was thin, she was white, she was very fair skinned, and she aspired to be a wife. She was definitely heterosexual, and she aspired also to be a mother. A lot of in-house suffrage campaigns, you know, depict this very like middle class white woman like sheltering a child, which is very intentional in terms of, you know, suffrage conveying to broader America that they're not trying to reinterpret what a woman is. Mainstream suffrage is conveying through these advertisements that they share these values of what a woman is supposed to be and what she is supposed to aspire to do. And so the way that they continued that messaging, literally one suffrage club named Macy's the headquarters of all suffrage supplies. Wow. And Macy's window displays were all, you know, decorated with like votes for women, sashes, and all these different, you know, accessories that you could buy. And literally in publications that advocated for the right to vote or organizing for the right to vote, the idea was that you should buy your politics and that you should support this messaging by buying these concepts and showcasing your politics that way. And I see a through line from that all the way through the, you know, feminist as fuck posters and desk tchotchkes and whatnot.
And as someone who peddles those things, I see it too. And so reading this book also,
I am white. I am a feminist. And I know that hashtag not all white women, hashtag not all feminists. I know. But it felt very personal in a lot of ways, like, oh, Ko is coming for me here. But I know that that's not the case. So I want to talk about how do we decentralize white feminism as white feminists? How do I do that? Mm-hmm. Or how do others like me do that, especially as business owners?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that a facet of this that is really worth mentioning and exploring is that the current framework, you know, of our country in terms of capitalism, commerce, like how business owners, much like you and also not like you, you know, like corporate heads, the country is made for white feminism in terms of a practice and a strategy. And so for someone like you, you know, you are set up to fail. Like you are set up to basically, not you specifically, but, you know, exploit other women for lower wages, hire freelancers who, you know, don't have healthcare, not really contribute at all, you know, to their quality of life, you know, no paid parental leave, like all these sorts of things. But again, that's what capitalism asks of you. And I think it's important to reframe this as a systemic failure. The reason why you might employ, you know, a woman who's like just had a baby and has to go back to work right away is because we don't have paid federal parental leave in this country. That's not necessarily your fault. That is a systemic failure. And that's very anomalous to the United States specifically. The reason why an employer is keen to discriminate against a single mother is very much linked to the fact that we don't have federal subsidized childcare in this country. If we did have universal childcare, that would not be an issue. So I think separating this from necessarily your own choices, but thinking about the systems that demand that you make those quote unquote choices and then, you know, laud you with like feminist messaging for participating in the system, I think that's something to keep in mind. Also, I think it's important for your listeners to know that I take great pains in the book to differentiate between, you know, feminists who happen to be white and then white feminists. I don't find that to necessarily be interchangeable. In fact, in the book, I make a point to include the very rich history of anti-racist white women in the South who gave a lot of examples in terms of their lives, you know, of how to be feminists who just happen to be white. What I do think is really interesting for those women in the South in like the 40s, 50s, 60s, especially who are very involved in civil rights causes, is that, you know, in terms of the broader, more mainstream like women's movement, those women were not a part of those movements. They often operated alone or they worked with Black leaders. So I think that's really telling in terms of the time, but also like what was available to them in terms of organizing and working with other white women, which was not very available to them.
And also it was probably a PR nightmare for the white women in the South that were, you know, organizing for or helping organize for anti-racist causes. And like you write in the book, it wasn't palatable for feminists to be aligned with the civil rights movement, to be aligned with anti-racist work, because it muddied the message. And I am seeing so much more of that now with the Black Lives Matter resurgence. Is racism a feminist issue? Absolutely. But we don't, a lot of times white feminism, as you have defined it, wants to overlook race in order to highlight our common sisterhood. And that's just not right. That's just not going to work. We can't overlook race and sexuality and ability and age and just focus on our shared gender and shared gender performance. It's not going to do anything good. So one of the questions that I have saying all of that is, how does white feminism operate and kind of steal these strategies from things like white supremacy, homophobia, ageism, heterosexism, ableism, xenophobia, all of those curiarchical institutions?
Well, one of the tactics that white feminism has been very successful at now and down through history is homogenizing the feminist experience. And I use that term very loosely in terms of not just what, you know, is a paramount gender issue, which, you know, I go into that in terms of my own history and my own work history, and then like my own experiences with white feminism working in newsrooms where, you know, the gender issues that I want to cover are not deemed gender issues by the outlets I work with or, you know, the managers I report to. But specifically being able to take this very like white, you know, cis middle class female experience and export that and globalize that as the feminist experience. That is white supremacy in practice. And it's been very, very successful. A lot of, you know, conversations that happen now nationally in terms of like, you know, I'm a poor woman, I'm a sex worker, I'm a domestic worker. Those are still sort of cast as one reactionary. So the idea that white feminism is the default feminism, that's been very successful. But also that for whatever reason, you're not supposed to bring those things up. That the idea is that you do want to aspire to be, you know, an entrepreneur. You do want to aspire to the C-suite. You do want to aspire to a heterosexual marriage with a cis man who also changes diapers. So it's very insidious and in some ways seductive, but also extremely successful.
Mm-hmm. I think your background in magazine editing and magazine writing is so interesting coming to this conversation, especially when it comes to kind of managing corporate and sales expectations while trying to subversively infuse the magazine outlet with some, I don't know, radical thinking. Can you talk a little bit about that experience as, you know, editor-in-chief or executive editor of some of these publications? I'm curious if you were stifled there and if that is what led to writing this book, or is that just an assumption I'm making?
I mean, you're not entirely wrong. I feel like at the, you know, beginning of my career, so I consider myself retired from leadership positions in media, but I was in women's media for 10 years. And I was always very, even when I was a lot younger, I was very pragmatic about it, which I do get into in the book and the introduction specifically in terms of, okay, you know, this is a very big platform. It has the capacity to reach a lot of people, especially a lot of women. What can I offer or pitch or edit or present that really expands ideas of gender? And, you know, throughout my career, and I get into this in a lot of detail, you know, that was definitely not the agenda of my employers. Gender was not supposed to be expanded at all. And while, you know, I don't think my time in women's media necessarily led me to this book, like this book is representative of a lot of my politics and politics that I've had earlier in my career, and that, you know, obviously given how mainstream the titles were, you know, not something that I necessarily shared on the page, mostly because there were a lot of institutional barriers to me doing that. I think that a big part of the conversation around white feminism and more broadly that has to change is this idea of like one senior person, you know, with very specific politics or, you know, approaches, being able to fix an entire organization. In some ways in my career, like I have been that person. Like I have been that, you know, mixed race queer woman that they hire and then are like, look, you know, like we got one. But it's a lot more complex than that in terms of the scope of what is being accomplished in deeply racist and heterosexist structures. One person is not capable of changing an entire culture and an entire structure in terms of thinking and relaying messages about, you know, women or other marginalized genders, non-binary people. And I think that literacy needs to be more baked in, because the thing is, when we do sort of laud, you know, some of these companies for hiring, you know, a Black woman in a senior capacity in 2019, it really downplays the scope of how these ideologies function. And, you know, it also sets that person up to fail like miserably because they will need a lot of institutional support, you know, whether it's through a union or like, you know, an in-house work policy group or, you know, senior management. Like they're going to need a lot of in-house support to pull off whatever you were expecting them to do as a trans person, as a Native person. And it's a really like stunted part of this narrative that I don't really see getting out there very much.
I'm so glad that you brought that up. I actually had just written down that when we put a marginalized person up on a pedestal in a position of leadership, they are absolutely set up to fail. And you talk about the systems, but also then that failure is used as an example as to why Black women can't lead, why trans folks can't lead. And I'm wondering, like, do you think that there's a critical mass that we have to hit of marginalized genders and marginalized people succeeding in order for that narrative to fall away or become less prominent? Or is this, do we have to, I don't know, I guess I'm thinking now, like, do we just have to dismantle white supremacy and sexism first? And can we do it hand in hand? I don't know.
I think that a big tactic that, again, white feminism has been very successful in when thinking about gender inequality is this messaging of what can you do? And right. The you is always individually. I get into this in the book as well, where it's like, you know, I've been speaking on panels about gender inequality for, you know, a big chunk of my career. And without fail, you know, very, very earnest, well-intentioned people raise their hand and are like, what can I do, you know, in my classroom, in my workplace? And the answer is that you as an individual cannot pull off very much. That is a lie that white feminism has told you. You need to think more collectively in terms of going up against these systems. You need to start unions. You need to think in terms of policies. You need to think beyond smash the patriarchy, you know, lists that you personally can assemble at your desk. And throughout history, there are a lot of examples of this, specifically from women who have built coalitions across race, across class, across sexual orientation. And I think in terms of your question about, you know, marginalized genders and what can be done there, you know, in terms of like white collar presence, corporate stuff like that, I think the expectation needs to be higher. I mean, if a company is throwing around a word like feminist, you know, which again, I get into in the book in terms of like branding, you know, versus policies, if they're using a word like that, what does that mean? Does that mean that, you know, they have paid parental leave? Does that mean that they have gender equity on their board? Does that mean that the women are making a decent wage? Does that mean that the health insurance is really good? I mean, I explore this a lot in terms of hearing that word, especially through my career. And I literally don't know what people are talking about.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about one of the examples from history, specifically the meat boycotts, of how that disrupted capitalism?
Yeah. So I'm happy you asked that. That was one of my, I think, more like giddy parts of the book.
I really enjoyed it. I didn't know anything about it.
I enjoyed it too. So for your listeners, basically meat boycotts in the United States are an exhilarating thread of women's activism. And down through history, I start in 1902 with Jewish housewives, specifically on the Lower East Side, who got wind essentially of the fact that the price of meat was going up an exorbitant amount. They don't have a lot of money. And as women, they are tasked obviously with feeding their families. And so it's very pragmatic in terms of they literally can't afford it. And they start boycotting meat, but together, you know, it wasn't like to think about it in contemporary ways, it wasn't like, you know, an individual woman was like, I am personally going to stop buying meat because I think it's wrong and you know, anti-family and anti-feminist. No, a bunch of Jewish housewives in 1902 in the Lower East Side all boycotted meat and sent the message far and wide. They made these incredible flyers with a skull and crossbones on them that discouraged people from buying meet because it was too expensive. And they were, I mean, incredible in terms of, you know, these were not what we think of as like young, idealistic 20 somethings. These were women well into their 30s who had upwards of four children and no, you know, official quote unquote like organizing experience. And they were incredibly successful in terms of they impacted the sales of meat to the point where the meat trust, as they were known, brought down the price because literally meat was spoiling. And it's a very good Achilles heel of capitalism, that if we live in this framework where money determines literally everything and sales and profit, you know, rank much higher than that of human life and especially women's lives, if you work with other people to step away from that and to explicitly not buy, history is in your favor. And meat activism like that continued. I document it through the 40s, 50s, and as late as the 70s. And women going to the supermarket and just being horrified at the price of meat. And what's also cool is that you see, or I try to set up in the book at least, like there's a real amazing, you know, echoing of kind of like what we would think of now as like Twitter organizing, where, you know, in 1902, the Jewish housewives in 1902 literally making these flyers and passing them out and going door to door and basically explaining why it was deeply insulting and inhumane to raise the price of meat this much. Through the 40s, housewives in other parts of the country, like the Midwest, more homes have telephones now at this point. So women would literally assign like phone trees to each other, tear out pages of the phone book, assign like 50 women, you know, to one specific woman and basically get on the phone and explain, like, did you know that, you know, that meat is being raised to this amount through, you know, Twitter and like hashtag yes, all women. And it's like a really exhilarating and affirming thing to see down through history that has been successful and that plays out now and is a continuation of basically the same strategy.
Yeah, one of the movements that I have really enjoyed seeing all the organizing around, and I think that I'm pretty sure you talk about this. I've just been reading a lot about the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights and all of Alicia Garza's work in that. And I see this through line, like you're talking about, that there's not a whole lot that domestic workers, housekeepers, and gardeners and cooks can do on their own. But when they are a collective, when they're working together and they're not boycotting anything, but they're demanding the rights that white collar workers have, we can see this collective change. Is that part of, do you write about the domestic workers' rights? Is that part of this book?
I do. Very much so. Yeah.
Okay. I read a lot. Can you talk a little bit about what they're working on and how that is kind of the antithesis of white feminists?
Sure. So the National Domestic Workers Alliance, which I interviewed Ai-Jin Poo for my book, who is their executive director, I believe, and they have been an advocacy group in the United States, basically advocating for exactly what you said, like what we would think of as protections for white collar workers, but for literally the women who sustain an entire sector of care work, the people who clean homes, take care of children, you know, take mother-in-laws to doctor's appointments, if that's the way that your family is structured. And a lot of, you know, what a white collar worker would be guaranteed in terms of like paid time off or, you know, some form of health insurance or, you know, an avenue by which to report abuses and not worry about retaliation or being basically kicked out of the country, you know, should they speak out about being denigrated at work or what have you. These protections have not been around for domestic workers. And I include the long history of that in my book in terms of different organizations trying to get protections for like laundry workers, as well as, you know, cleaners and things like that. In terms of contemporary times, how we exist now, a number of states that I cite in my book have the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights on legislation. So a lot of the things that we're talking about, that means that through state law, their rights are enshrined. In 2019, there were significant efforts to basically elevate that to the federal Bill of Domestic Workers' Rights. And our now Vice President-elect, Kamala Harris, she introduced that bill. And so I analyzed that a bit in the book, and also the basically understanding that, you know, for a lot of women and marginalized genders in this country, the passing of this bill is feminism. And I think that especially as Kamala takes office and, you know, is inaugurated soon, I think that's something that we should collectively look ahead towards, is pieces of legislation like that.
Yeah. I wanted to land on that and end on that, because I think that is a great example of collective organizing and what intersectional feminism looks like on the ground in everyday lives. And it's not the empowerment feminism. It's not, like, that's not the feminism that militant feminists, happily, you know, consider myself one, subscribe to. It's this getting your hands dirty, doing the service work, organizing, collective bargaining, and when we take care of the most marginalized and make sure that they have human rights and dignity, that's when we can make broader changes in this world.
Well, and even bigger beyond that, I mean, for a large swath of organized rights in this country, not through white feminism, but through, you know, Black feminism, a lot of different, you know, facets of like queer feminism, organizing that's been done by Native women, human dignity is feminism.
Yeah.
And being paid a decent wage, being not exploited at work, having bathroom breaks, you know, having a limited work day, being able to leave if you have an emergency with a child, that is feminism.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today and share your book with us. And I'm so excited for this book to be out in the world. I think it is required reading for any feminist, anyone who calls themselves a feminist. So we end with two softball questions. And the first is, do you have a book that's not your own that you would recommend to our audience?
Yes, very much so. I recently, prior to going on book tour, I recently finished Sisters in Hate by Sayward Darby. It is an analysis of the women who are on the front lines and very visible in the white nationalist movement. It's very fascinating, deeply researched. Sayward basically embedded with three different women who have worked in white nationalism and got incredible access to not only their lives, but also, you know, their thought processes and how they're thinking as women when they work within these deeply racist theologies. And it's very dark, but the reporting is just incredible.
Wow. I haven't heard of that yet. I'm it's really excited book. To get my hands on it. Wow. Sisters in Hate by Sayward Darby, you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We will link that in the show notes, as well as White Feminism by Koa Beck. And Koa, where can we find you online if we want to follow more of your work?
Oh, literally anywhere. Oh, except TikTok. Sorry, I didn't do that.
I just got on TikTok. I don't recommend it as a time suck.
It's just not my platform. But I'm on everything. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I have a public Facebook, you know, that has my book tour events and things like that. So come visit me.
Excellent. Will do. We'll put those in the show notes as well. Thank you so, so much for joining me today.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh. A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.